Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Security forces in Myanmar have reportedly occupied more than 60 schools and university campuses, the United Nations Children's Fund UNICEF said on Friday. In at least one incident, security forces reportedly beat two teachers and left several others injured, the agency said in a joint statement with the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization UNESCO and the NGO Save the Children. These incidents mark a further escalation of the current crisis and represent a serious violation of the rights of children. Schools must not be used by security forces under any circumstances, they said. The development comes amid continuing violence linked to protests against the 1st of February coup by the country's military. The UN agencies warned that the occupation will exacerbate the learning crisis for almost 12 million children and youth in Myanmar, which was already under tremendous pressure owing to the COVID-19 pandemic and the ensuing widespread closures. They urged security forces to vacate occupied premises immediately and ensure that they are not used by military or security personnel. To the Human Rights Council now, and a warning from UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet that brutality and discrimination against people of African descent continue to occur. Ms. Bachelet's comments come 10 months since the killing of 46-year-old African-American George Floyd, who died after an officer knelt on his neck for over 8 minutes in Minneapolis, sparking worldwide protests, including the Black Lives Matter movement. The High Commissioner's comments also coincided with the U.S. trial of the former police officer accused of being responsible for Mr. Floyd's killing. In an appeal on Friday for states to take action, the High Commissioner for Human Rights insisted that no police officer or any other agent of any state should ever be above the law. But she said that we can never fix the police until wider prejudice in society and its institutions is addressed in education, housing, health and work. Belarus, finally, where a top independent rights expert has spoken out against the increasing crackdown of rights activists linked to ongoing protests over disputed presidential elections in August last year. UN Special Rapporteur Mary Lawler issued the alert on Friday, citing suspected reprisals against individuals who've worked with the UN to promote the rights of people with disabilities. Raids on offices, the arrests of rights defenders and lawyers have become common practice, Lawler said in a statement, highlighting the cases of Sergei Drozdovsky and Oleg Grablevsky, who have cooperated with the UN Human Rights Office. Both had been arrested in connection to their human rights work, said Lawler. She noted that Mr. Drozdovsky, who is director of the Office of Rights for People with Disabilities and a wheelchair user, endured a 7-hour-long interrogation, while Mr. Grablevsky, a legal advisor, was told to remove his clothes during questioning. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can subscribe by emailing me at naomi@taxjustice.net or find us on your favourite podcast app. Coming up later, the world's broken. Apparently we need $9 trillion to fix it.
We can do this. You know, there are solutions. The next 20 years could be one in which we rebuild a more just global economic system.
I'm going to speak to Ben Tippett of the Transnational Institute, who's done the sums. There are three pieces of really good news to tell you this month. Firstly, it's Portugal's turn at the European Union presidency helm, and after years of campaigning, they're putting a tax transparency law for corporations, country-by-country reporting, to a vote in the Council of Ministers. It makes it easier for us to know basically where companies should actually be paying their taxes. Germany's been a key blocker on this, but the vote's now going ahead. The corporate lobbies have managed to include plenty of loopholes though, so it's not perfect, but it's a step forward. And secondly, incredible news, what the Tax Justice Network calls an outright global triumph for the advocacy efforts of the tax justice movement. The United Nations Financial Accountability, Transparency and Integrity Panel has called for a UN tax convention. It's also backed our ABCs of tax justice solutions, so that's automatic multilateral exchange of information, beneficial ownership registers, those are public registers of the real owners of companies, and country-by-country reporting for corporations. The heat is now on to move rulemaking on tax from the rich country club of the OECD to the UN, as we've called for many years. And finally, the tax justice movement has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. The Global Alliance for Tax Justice has been nominated jointly with our friends at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Great stuff. Okay, we're going to speak to John Christensen now for his take on this month. We recorded this just yesterday about the crazy GameStop frenzy. And since then, the GameStop share price is soaring again. Madness. Okay, John, we've had a great demonstration of everything that's wrong with our economies and why they're not really going anywhere with this GameStop saga. And it shows yet again, doesn't it, why we so desperately need financial transactions taxes to discourage stock exchange casino business, which has nothing to do with real investment or the real economy. So GameStop is an ailing video game seller. The whole thing was spun as the valiant little guy supposedly championing the stock market by sabotaging a series of Wall Street hedge funds by revenge buying this GameStop stock. Without going too far down the rabbit hole of speculative trading, what actually did happen there, John?
Well, good question. For those not familiar with North American shopping malls, GameStop is a retail business specializing in video games and games consoles and related electronics, much of which nowadays is bought online. Even before the pandemic, the company's turnover was being impacted by online sales. And more closures since the pandemic started have merely accelerated that trend towards buying online. So some analysts working for hedge funds, which specialize in a process known as shorting, realized that GameStop shares were considerably overvalued, and they had been trading in single figures in 2019 and early 2020. And so these analysts thought they could profit from the situation by taking a bet that the share price would go down. Now, normally when they do this, they simply borrow shares from a stockbroker, they sell the shares at the current high price, watch the share price plummet, buy back at that lower price, and return the borrowed stock to the stockbroker, pocketing vast profits which they've made. But that's not how it worked with GameStop. In late autumn 2020, the hedgies moved in to start shorting the GameStop shares. But some investors noted the shares were being shorted, and they saw an opportunity to do what's called a short squeeze. So using social media, including YouTube and Reddit, they put out a whole load of promotional materials boosting GameStop's prospects. Now, loads of individual investors and quite a few institutional investors as well saw an opportunity to sting the shorters. So they bought into the stock, watching the share price rise from about $20 a piece at the beginning of January to close to $500 at one stage in January 2021. At the moment of peak frenzy in January, GameStop shares were trading at $483, which is 24 times the trading price at the start of that month. In January, the buying was so frantic that a major retail share trading app, which is known as Robinhood, widely used by individual investors because it provides its services for free, Robinhood had to block customers from buying GameStop shares, claiming that they simply didn't have enough liquidity to handle the volume of share trading at such a high price level.
Right, and I believe when Robinhood wanted to recapitalize, where did they get that from? They got it from the big banks.
Yes, they very quickly borrowed a few extra $1 billion to get the buying up and running again, but not before loud complaints came from investors shouting that they were being excluded from the feeding frenzy. Now, several things happened during the course of those two crazy weeks in January. First, the hedge funds, which originally set out to short GameStop shares, found that the share price went up rather than down. And the more the share price rose, the more they stood to lose. And some funds, like Melvin Capital, have taken a spectacular hit running to billions of dollars. Second, while some of the retail investors who bought in early to the short squeeze, they made a whole bunch of money and sold out before the bubble peaked. But then a lot of other people got the timing wrong. They saw the share price surging. They borrowed money to buy the, whatever shares they could lay their hands on. And then they watched the share price tumble, leaving them holding shares which couldn't be sold for love nor money. These people have lost a lot of money from gambling at the very peak of a bubble. They should have known better, but greed and herd instinct took over. For what it's worth, GameStop shares were trading at $40 this morning when I looked at the market price. So if you bought shares at the peak price in January, you're currently facing a loss of over 90% of your investment.
Right. So I should preface my next question with the knowledge that, you know, when you go into the casino always wins. And this idea that we can all become kind of miniature financiers is really an illusion. And whilst there may have been a blip where a few small people got to play with the big boys, and it nearly all is boys, who are the real winners and the losers in this scenario? There were lots of fairly big hedge funds and banks that also benefited from this whole frenzy. Let's talk about the heroes and the villains of this piece.
Look, we have villains aplenty, but I don't see any heroes in this story. Now, some commentators have tried to spin this as a story of common Joe, and you're right, it's mainly men, up against the machine. So ordinary investors taking on the hedge fund billionaires. But that is way, way too starry-eyed. It's much more accurate to talk about one kind of gambler taking on another kind of gambler, with the banks lending money to everyone as they took their seats at the gambling table. And that's what happened. Now, one of the interesting things about GameStop is how stock market influencers used social media to persuade investors that there was money to be made from squeezing the short positions of the big bad hedge funds. Now, some people, including some prominent politicians, have claimed that internet posts were being used to manipulate the GameStop share price in a, what's called a pump and dump scheme. In other words, you pump the price up and then you dump them as soon as you see quick killings to be made. But this kind of manipulation is very hard to prove in a court of law. And the online boosters, and there were plenty of them, they can always claim that they were just exercising their right to free speech. This is the way the markets work. There may well be an inquiry or even multiple inquiries into what actually happened during those weeks of frenzied trading. But I'm not expecting that anyone will be found guilty of market manipulation. Those hedgies love to talk about the markets as a jungle, so it's a bit rich for them to complain when the junior predators bite back. But it's equally rich for the small-scale gamblers, I mean, sorry, investors, to moan about not getting their fair share of the pickings from the GameStop carcass.
It sort of seems to be the casino winning again and again and again, despite some of these smaller people getting together in this way. But what does all this tell us about contemporary capitalism and how we fix that?
Now, in theory, the stock markets should lead to optimal allocation of investment. Investors should identify viable companies producing useful goods and useful services, and their investments should support company directors with building the company and producing those goods and services. But in the same way that Bitcoin has surged in price, it was about $30,000 a month ago per Bitcoin. Now it's just shy of $50,000 today. The GameStop bubble has no rooting in any kind of economic reality. And this especially applies to the day trading community who piled into the GameStop share trading frenzy. They're making speculative short-term trades. Now, the British economist, Professor Susan Strange, gave this kind of capitalism a name. She called it casino capitalism. And her book on that subject is probably one of the most important economic books of the late 20th century. One reform which really might help to discourage these kind of trading frenzies is currently being considered by the New York State Assembly. That's a proposal which was filed this week to reinstate a provision for a stock transfer tax. And it's interesting that senior officials in the Biden administration are showing interest not just in the stock transfer tax, but more generally in financial transaction taxes. And I think that's encouraging.
Yeah, it's a hugely under-taxed area, and there's a need, isn't there, to reclaim the word investment, because real investment, I mean, if we have a think about it, would I rather my pension was invested long term into a cooperative, let's say, a care home run by nurses, or a renewable energy company owned by its staff, no shares, no huge CEO bonuses, no private equity involved, long-term decision-making, innovation and all of that? Or would I rather my pension flies from the seat of its pants on split-second trading of the kind that we see every day?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and important point you make there about investment, the word investment. As you say, so much of what they call investment is just speculation. But perhaps importantly, such a huge proportion of the cross-border investment is not being made into new productive activities. It's going into mergers and acquisitions, which are leading to market concentration, concentrations of power and monopolies. And that's not at all good for an economy, or it's going into real estate, or not into productive activity. So the term investment is very widely used and abused by politicians and by journalists, and we need to think much more carefully about what kind of policies would serve best to restore investment or to push investment into a productive economy, rather than into the kind of extractive economy that I think typifies Wall Street and the City of London and some of the other big financial centres in the modern economy and in contemporary capitalism more generally.
Yeah, and there's another thing that can be done, which is to restrict how quickly shares change hands.
Yes, absolutely. The average period of holding shares has fallen dramatically in the last 40 years. And perhaps there needs to be a recognition that shares should be held for a minimum period, maybe a few months, before they earn dividends and so on. Because this type of short-term speculative trading doesn't help company directors to invest for the long term. It has created a very short-term attitude in most of the major financial markets. This is extremely unhelpful, particularly at the moment when we need to see huge investment directed towards a new energy-efficient, non-fossil fuel market. There's a huge transition facing humanity, and at the moment I don't think markets are in any way geared to making that kind of transition.
Thanks, John. And yes, we're on the cusp of major transition, and we can't dodge the hard choices anymore. Climate change is already hurting people in many parts of the world, and now the pandemic is hitting everyone at the moment. In history, we've seen how huge change can come after catastrophe. I've got Ben Tippett of the fantastic Transnational Institute with me today. He says we can fix it. He's written a report called Paying for the Pandemic and a Just Transition. Welcome, Ben.
Fantastic. Yeah, thanks, Naomi, for inviting me on the podcast. I love the podcast and also the work of Tax Justice Network. I use quite a lot of your research in the report, and I'd really recommend anyone go and see what you're doing there if you want any understanding of what's going on in global finance and global economics.
Thanks. So, Ben, you've calculated that the world needs $9 trillion in spending, and your report tells us exactly how the world can raise that $9 trillion. You make the really important point right at the beginning of your report that even the IMF now agrees that rich governments who control their own currency can increase spending. And you describe that as a welcome departure from the false austerity narrative of the past 10 years, that the books always need to be balanced. So really the point is that the onus is on rich governments to spend whatever is needed today. And it's really important, I think, before we talk about your solutions, that we so need to tackle this scarcity argument that's such a strong narrative internalized by so many people. We do have the resources to solve the world's challenges and the global south's challenges at the same time. So because of that ability by wealthy countries with strong currencies to create money, some of the solutions we're going to talk about must involve wealth transfers, or you could say investments really, from the global north. And these are investments in all our futures, in all our interests.
Yeah, we need to make those who have the most economic ability pay for this crisis, because they are the ones who are able to bear the costs without violating their fundamental human or economic rights. And actually, in some cases, we find that those with the greatest ability to pay are themselves the ones who are most responsible for these crises. So the aim of the report really is to say, we can do this. You know, there are solutions.
And so you make the point as well that we don't need to worry so much about the COVID debts wealthy governments are running up at the moment.
Yeah, interest rates are at a historically low level. You know, interest rates are themselves decided upon by governments and central banks, well, by central banks in particular. So it's not that they suddenly drop out of the sky. The government can have smaller repayments when interest rates are historically lower. And this is, as you say, a very welcome departure from the austerity narrative. That said, we do still need to be thinking about taxation and redistributive policies at a global level. And that's partly because this idea of printing more money and going into more debt is really just a solution for governments in the global north.
Yes, exactly. And if you take the UK, for example, we basically owe ourselves the money. And you have to bear in mind all this is about investment. It's not just spending. But for nations that are hamstrung by debt and don't have strong currencies, yeah, it's not an option. And your report looks at how those things can be overcome. It's shocking that 64 countries are paying more on servicing debt than they are on healthcare.
Yeah, there's a ensuing debt crisis in the global south. It's to do with the fact that we need taxation policies to tackle inequality, militarism and climate change. COVID has opened up an opportunity to shape the economic discourse, you know, to say the next 20 years could be one in which we rebuild a more just global economic system, given the amount of suffering that people have had to go through over the last few years and before.
Yes, and that reminds me of what they call the spirit of 1945 in Europe, when people who suffered so much during the Second World War and sacrificed such a lot demanded genuine deep change. I mean, in the UK, we eventually got the welfare state and the National Health Service, things like that. So, okay, you've estimated in your report that over the next decade, the world needs $9 trillion every year to settle the costs of the pandemic, tackle the climate crisis, and make sure that people everywhere have basic human rights. So things like being able to go to a doctor or a hospital, having drinkable water and education, not going hungry. And you have two branches to your report. You've got solutions, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and you identify six spending needs for the world. I prefer to call them investments.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. And actually, it's interesting you say you prefer investments. Maybe investments captures more the building aspect of this and the opening up of new opportunities. So yeah, there's six basic costs and investments: the problems of the pandemic, of climate change, of the Sustainable Development Goals, climate reparations, and reparations for slavery. So the estimations for these generally come from the UN, the OECD, from the IMF. They tend to be quite mainstream institutions.
Right. Tot all that up and you end up with $9 trillion worth of spending or investment that we need each year over the next 10 years to get the world out of the severe trouble that it's in. So let's just look at one of those before we talk about how we can fix all these. Let's look at the climate investments we need to make. Just to stand still in the global south, you say $300 billion a year is needed in climate reparations, and that's just to pay for the loss and damages of climate change there.
You know, many countries in the global south are suffering irreversible losses and costly damages from droughts, floods, typhoons, all of these kind of severe weather events. One of the estimates for how much these countries are losing in loss and damages is roughly around $300 billion per year. And this is something that could be paid in a form of a climate reparation from the global north to the global south to deal with those loss and damages. You might be thinking, but don't the global north also suffer from loss and damages from climate change? They do, but really the global south suffers apparently more than 90% of the costs, and also 98% of the deaths associated with climate change.
Right, and then you've estimated there's a $3 trillion bill for fixing the climate crisis globally.
Yeah, just so we have like a ballpark of how much money we're talking about here. So according to the UN, the World Bank, and the International Governmental Panel on Climate Change, we're going to need roughly $3 trillion per year to decarbonize the global economy and fight climate change. So what's that money going to be spent on? It's going to be on things like decarbonizing energy production, manufacturing processes, transportation, all of this kind of stuff. Within that, though, we also need to think about the historic inequities and the historic injustice that is really embedded within climate change.
Okay, it's good to understand the scale of the investments that are needed. Let's have the good news then on how we can get those resources and why we know it absolutely can be done. Your 10 proposals. So number one on your list is global wealth taxes. That you estimate could raise over $4 trillion a year, which is really incredible.
Yeah, of course. So this is, I guess, the big headline proposal. You know, it's the most revenue generating proposal. If you're in the top 0.01% of the global wealth distribution, you pay an effective tax rate of 10%. But actually that in and of itself would also be spread out so that people at the top would be paid much higher amounts. It's effectively, in a way, a proposal that would provide a kind of upper limit on how wealthy you could get. The fact that we have wealth levels that are much, much bigger than income. You know, wealth to income ratios have been rising very much over the last few years. And wealth tends to be part of our economy that's massively undertaxed at the moment. And what we're seeing, I think, particularly with the COVID pandemic, is progressive wealth taxes becoming more and more mainstream, being more seriously considered by policymakers. There's some interesting stuff happening around them in Latin America. And also, I think Spain has put out ideas of implementing some progressive wealth taxes.
Yes, and polling shows that wealth taxes are overwhelmingly popular with voters. If you look at taxing offshore wealth alone, I mean, the estimates, and of course they have to be estimates, don't they, because of the secrecy levels involved. The estimates say it's up to $32 trillion being held offshore. So there's a huge need for a global asset registry and for transparency in tax havens to facilitate fair taxation. And your second proposal reckons just from taxing capital income from offshore private wealth could raise $125 billion a year.
Exactly, yeah. I think really, even if we didn't implement a new wealth tax, and we were able to tax the income, just the income that people earn from their offshore wealth, it would still be within the hundreds of billions of dollars that are evaded or that could be raised if this stuff was brought onshore. It does tend to be the richest people that hide their wealth offshore. Something like two-fifths of the wealthiest 0.01% in Colombia evade taxes, with these people kind of roughly concealing around a third of their wealth offshore. So it's very much pervasive, and it has to be part of any platform to implement some kind of globally coordinated wealth tax system.
Okay, third on your list of fixes is the excess profits tax, which is something the Tax Justice Network's been advocating. And you know, it's interesting that you point out that it's been done before.
Yeah, we know that there are some corporations that have benefited hugely from the crisis. I'm thinking the big tech giants, Amazon, Google, Apple, also Microsoft.
And Netflix.
if it's true, actually, yeah, absolutely. They've benefited hugely from the crisis. Should anyone be able to make profits from such an unexpected, exogenous shock that really has nothing to do with their own making? Actually, should any company be earning such abnormal profits that aren't taxed at a higher rate? 95% of corporate profits, excess corporate profits, were taxed in the UK during the war. So it has been done before, and it very much could be done again. You know, corporate profits are still very much unequally distributed. If you take the US as an example, which is where we have some of the best data on this, when you actually kind of work out how those corporate profits actually get down to individuals and households, well, the wealthiest 10% of Americans now own around 89% of all stocks. And I think something like the bottom half of Americans don't even own a single percent of company equities. So there's a huge equality equity-based reason why we have to tax these corporate profits and use it as a way to redistribute for more social spending.
If we talk about Proposal 4, so taxing offshore corporate profits alone could raise $200 to $600 billion a year. Just looking at what companies are putting offshore and taxing that is also very significant.
Yeah, corporate tax evasion is an interesting one to look at, how recent it is and how it's not inevitable and it's not innate and it's not natural and it's something that we can definitely clamp down on and change. So just the threat that companies could move and locate to Ireland or the Canary Islands pushes down corporate tax rates across all countries in the world.
The OECD's been fiddling around with the idea of a 12.5% global minimum corporate tax rate. Pretty ridiculous. We think we need at least a minimum rate of 28% worldwide.
Yeah, I think maybe a good minimum rate would be roughly around 28%, bringing us on the way back up to where corporate tax rates were in the 1970s.
Let's look at Proposal 5, a financial transactions tax, which could raise between $237 and $418.8 billion annually. And that's quite a modest tax proposal in terms of the percentage you're talking about. And you can listen to edition 107 of the TaxCast for how much further a financial transactions tax could go. Financial transactions taxes are gaining momentum in New York, in the EU. There are some advances there. It's really all about reining in unproductive speculation and bubbles.
Yeah, this whole business with GameStop, this exposes a lot of the wild speculation and gambling that goes on in the financial sector and just how completely divorced it is from productive investment or from, quote, the real economy or from, you know, financing all the things from fighting climate change or tackling the sustainable development goals, all the things we're talking about here. We really need to take out a lot of the speculative incentives within the financial system. The financial sector is propped up at the moment and supported by public money, by central banks doing quantitative easing, by central banks having low interest rates, by the huge amount of public money that has been injected into the system. And then I think, you know, the idea that some of that money has to be reclaimed through taxation at some point has to be part of its solution.
Yeah, and it's amazing how people seem to accept subsidies going in some directions, but it's so controversial in others. And your Proposal 6 is really an interesting one, because that's all about eliminating public subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, which are absolutely huge. The UK is one of the biggest for fossil fuel subsidies. And you also talk about implementing a tax on the cost of pollution that could raise an extra $3.2 trillion a year.
Yeah, direct subsidies by governments to the fossil fuel industry are still huge, roughly around $300 to $500 billion a year. We know that we have to transition away from fossil fuels. Taxes, I think, do have to be part of this solution, but if not properly designed, this kind of tax can end up hitting poorest households the hardest. And I think part of the solution then has to be about building publicly owned, democratically organized renewable energy with the money and providing a kind of sufficient social welfare.
Yeah, redistribution at its heart. If we move on and talk about Proposal 7, you estimate redirecting 10% of global military spending towards fighting the real security crises could raise up to $191 billion a year globally. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, there's a kind of opportunity cost, I guess, with every pound that we spend on military spending that means that we're not spending it on this broader understanding of human security. Since the beginning of the war on terror in 2001, the US military has contributed to displacing roughly around 37 million people. So that's around the entire population of Canada. There are some examples of countries doing something similar. So South Korea, it has a basically a militarized border with North Korea, said that it would trim next year's defense budget by 2% in order to provide money to tackle the COVID pandemic. And Thailand as well said it will cut its military defense budget by 8% in order to provide money to tackle COVID. So, you know, other countries are following suit in often quite a tense geopolitical part of the world.
Yes. All right, let's look at Proposal 8, a debt jubilee. That could free up the equivalent of $100 billion a year for the Global South over the next 10 years, apparently. 64 countries are currently paying more on debt servicing than they are on healthcare. That's really shocking.
It really hits home just how trapped I think so many countries are within our global debt system. We have to embed this debt crisis within the legacy of, firstly, neoliberalism, and also the longer history of colonial inequality.
Yeah. And Proposal 9, this could warrant an entire programme, several programmes by itself, but a new issuance of special drawing rights that would free up the equivalent of $250 billion a year for the Global South over the next 10 years. Proposal 10, that's $50 billion a year for the Global South over the next 10 years, with a new Marshall Plan.
Yeah, so in addition to debt write-offs and special drawing rights, there should also be aid given from the Global North to the Global South to fight the COVID pandemic. I mean, with the vaccine and everything that's been happening around this, we can see so clearly the fact that what happens in one country affects another country. You know, a variant in one country can spread to another country. And the idea that we can just isolate ourselves and not have to think about the similar economic impacts of cutting aid or not fighting this on a globally systemic level, I think will come back to haunt and come back to bite those of us in the Global North.
Yes, in the same way as the rich world is hoarding vaccines, it's not going to work. I've been talking to Ben Tippett about his Transnational Institute report, Paying for the Pandemic and a Just Transition. Read the report in full. The link to the report's in the show notes. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.
Hello, in this week's show we're getting the latest expert advice from the UN Health Agency on what to make of clotting concerns surrounding COVID vaccines. We'll also hear about a mounting death toll among protesters in Myanmar, and we'll be highlighting a good news story from Cambodia, thanks to UNAIDS, where the agency has had to react fast to the new challenges facing people with HIV during the coronavirus pandemic. I'm your host, Daniel Johnson, and I'll be joined later for this UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva by Solange Berhotegui-Cortez from the Information Service at UN Geneva. Thanks for listening. First, the news. International experts advising the UN Health Agency have allayed concerns over blood clots that have been associated by some countries with coronavirus jabs without definitive evidence. The expert panel, SAGE, said that bleeding events are a symptom of COVID-19. The development comes as the European Medicines Agency announced on Thursday that the AstraZeneca coronavirus jab is safe to use. It also follows the approval of the one-shot Janssen COVID vaccine by SAGE on Wednesday, which followed trials involving 44,000 people who developed 10 blood clots, also called thromboembolic events, in the placebo test group versus 14 in the vaccinated candidates. This was not statistically significant, SAGE technical advisor Dr. Annalise Wilder-Smith told journalists during a virtual press conference in Geneva.
We need to be reminded that the vaccine intentionally recruited persons that are at higher risk of COVID. So older persons, persons with comorbidities, obesity, who may have naturally already a higher risk of thromboembolic events. So I think we could use this, the 10 out of the 22,000, as kind of a background.
At the same press conference, SAGE hailed the one-dose Janssen shot as a safe and life-saving addition to the three other vaccines it has already approved for use, Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca. Here's SAGE member Dr. Kate O'Brien, an immunization expert from the World Health Organization.
The world is in a place where there is insufficient supply to meet the requirements of people who need to be vaccinated. And clearly, any of these vaccines are life-saving products. They need to be used as quickly as we can get them deployed. People can have confidence in their safety and efficacy and in the quality of the manufacturing of the products.
To Myanmar and an appeal from the UN Rights Chief to the Security Council for all states which have influence to end the deadly violence against protesters there following the coup on the 1st of February. High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet's call on Tuesday came as her office said that at least 149 people had been confirmed victims since the military takeover. At least 11 were killed on Monday and 57 died over the weekend. And there are many more reports of further killings that the UN Rights Office said it has not been able to corroborate. Spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani told journalists in Geneva that the High Commissioner had appealed for all states which have influence to take measures to ensure that the violence comes to an end.
There is really a clear need for a unified message from the Security Council to, one, stress that this violence needs to be brought to an end, and two, call for accountability of the perpetrators of this violence and of previous severe human rights violations that were committed by the military.
The situation is dire and getting worse by the day, said Ms. Shamdasani, who added that the High Commissioner believed that any sanctions imposed against Myanmar should be targeted against specific military officials rather than broad sanctions that may impact on the wider population. Now to this week's interview, which is a welcome good news story from Cambodia and UNAIDS, where the agency had to think on its feet to react to the challenges posed by the COVID-19 crisis, as country director for Cambodia, Vladanka Andreeva, told me.
You know, I think people living with HIV in Cambodia, as well, you know, as the rest of the Cambodians, were really under a huge stress. Not only a health stress, but also a lot of stress was put on the economy of the country. And I think in particular for people living with HIV, one of the fears was, would they have continued access to both prevention and treatment services? So, you know, early in the pandemic last year, what UNAIDS has done together with the National AIDS Program, with the communities and different local organizations, we did a survey. We went and we asked people living with HIV and so-called key population, men who have sex with men, people who use drugs, transgender people, sex workers, what are their fears? How can we help them? What's the access to prevention and treatment services for them like since the COVID-19 pandemic started? And based on those answers, we decided to introduce early monitoring, and we're really looking at early indication of disruption of services. Second, we try to be a bit more innovative in the way we are offering services. You know, usually, in particular, the prevention services are offered in outreach work, which means people are going outside when we know where key populations are and offering prevention services, education, access to HIV testing to them outside. However, now we have moved most of the offer for HIV prevention services in the virtual world. We're using different social media platforms to reach out to them, and we have introduced HIV self-testing as yet another option.
So you feared the worst when the COVID-19 pandemic really shut down the country, and that included the closure of the biggest and oldest HIV treatment site in the capital, Phnom Penh. That was repurposed, wasn't it, to help COVID-19 patients?
True. One of the first efforts that Ministry of Health has done since the onset of the pandemic is really to have a central COVID-19 center. Unfortunately, the chosen selection was the oldest HIV treatment site in the capital. So what we have done, again, collectively with Ministry of Health and the National AIDS Program, we have ensured smooth transition of all patients, and that was the largest cohort of patients in Phnom Penh, into a new treatment site. We have provided, in addition to the services that have been offered, plus additional counselors, just to make sure that people knew where to go next and how to take up their medicines. And we have also provided face masks, and sanitizers. The second effort that we have made is really we have used COVID-19 as an accelerator for promotion of multi-month dispensing of treatment. What does that mean? Instead of going every month to pick up your antiretroviral treatment, now people can go and pick up their treatment every 3 months, and some of them even on 6 month basis. That means that they go less frequently to the treatment sites, which limits their exposure to COVID-19, but also saves them money that they would spend normally on transport.
So there's been no problem getting hold of HIV medicines during the pandemic and during the import-export restrictions that we've seen.
One of the biggest fears, obviously, was the potential indirect impact of COVID-19 on the supply chain. We were lucky enough that we have not recorded any shortages of medicine in Cambodia. We have started this multi-month dispensing before the onset of the pandemic. But, you know, 1 year ago, we had only 34% of people who are on treatment having access to multi-month dispensing. Today, we have more than 54% of people on treatment that have 3 or 6 months supply of their medicines.
And is there any stigma associated with HIV still in Cambodia, as there might be with COVID-19, or at least in the beginning?
Well, we are still not immune to stigma and discrimination. And, you know, and this is sometimes coupled with a reluctance to disclose one HIV status, because the key population that I have referred to earlier on, men who have sex with men, people who use drugs, entertainment workers, transgender women, sometimes they buy or sell sex. And these people are really hard to reach with HIV intervention. And I think, again, this whole innovation of moving some of the services into the virtual space has opened a door to reach some of these unreached population and offer services to them, but also making sure that the uptake, particularly of HIV testing, as knowing your HIV status is very important, then you can know if and what prevention measures you should uptake, or if your HIV status is positive, how to get on treatment is very, very important.
UNAIDS is advocating that all countries, ministries of health and national AIDS programs, grant access to 3 months or more of antiretroviral therapy for all people with HIV, including refugees and migrants. So how many countries currently support this three-month, this multi-month dispensary of HIV drugs?
In this region, Asia and the Pacific, most of the countries have already adopted that into their national programs. And I think, you know, Cambodia is not unique by using COVID-19 as an opportunity, really, to scale up this initiative.
UNAIDS Country Director for Cambodia, Vladanka Andreeva there. And you can hear the longer version of that interview on UN News/AudioHub now. You're listening to UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. Also with me is Solange Behaltege-Cortez from UN Geneva's Information Service. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel.
So I thought it was interesting to hear how the UN agency and its partners have adapted to new COVID challenges, giving several months of HIV medicines at a time, and also turning to social media platforms to keep people with HIV informed about their options.
Yeah, well, this year marks 40 years of HIV and AIDS. 4 decades living with a pandemic that has claimed the lives of many and has generated stigma and discrimination. And this year, we also commemorate the 25th anniversary of the United Nations Program on HIV and AIDS, UNAIDS, 25 years working with civil society and communities to find local solutions and fight a pandemic that many people think only happens to others, gay people, people who use drugs. But of course, this affects us all, one way or another. And as many people from the UN Secretary General down have been saying all along with the COVID pandemic, no one is safe until everyone is safe. this essential lesson of solidarity applies to beating HIV. But we have a third pandemic, and this one is hidden, the gender equality pandemic. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in opening remarks to the 65th session of the Commission on the Status of Women on Monday that the COVID-19 is a crisis with a woman's face. And here I would like to add that it is the woman's face in all its diversity. Finally, I have a friend who is HIV positive, and because he takes retroviral medicine, he thinks he is immune to COVID. Misinformation has become synonymous with the pandemic. This infodemic spreads faster than a virus. The most effective response to fight pandemics is to end inequality and generate reliable information. Pause. Take care before you share.
Thank you, Solange. Absolutely. Take care before you share, and we should talk about that because the UN has a verified campaign which is aimed at delivering trusted information, life-saving advice and stories from the best of humanity. And you can get involved by becoming an information volunteer and sharing UN verified science-based content which will keep your family safe, your community safe, as well as connected to the latest scientific advice. If you want to take part, you can sign up as an information volunteer at www.shareverified.com. And then going back to your comments, Solange, thank you for those. Ending AIDS as a public health threat by 2030 is a sustainable development goal, which all UN member states have signed up to. In June, the UN General Assembly will be planning next steps. And last month, UNAIDS Chief Winnie Bien-Nima said that the AIDS epidemic is unfinished business and must be ended for everyone, everywhere, in particular for young women and adolescent girls who are among those disproportionately affected by HIV. So there we are. We are out of time. We'll be back next week with another UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva. Thanks as ever to Justine Bryce, who is in the wings with her production help. Bye-bye for now.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. When COVID-19 locked down Cambodia last year, people with HIV were afraid that they'd lose life-saving access to regular supplies of antiretroviral drugs. Fortunately, that never happened, thanks to a successful new medicines distribution scheme and a little bit of help from social media platforms too, as UNAIDS Country Director Vladanka Andreeva told UN News' Daniel Johnson.
So let me start from the beginning, and let me just say that when it comes to the state of play of HIV, Cambodia is doing really super well. It has been recognized as one of the 7 countries globally that have achieved the so-called 19-19-90 targets as early as 2017.
Can I just jump in there, Vladanka? What's that 19-19-90, please?
19-90-90 are global targets that have been set. The first 90 target speaks to the percentage of people that should know their HIV status, that's 90%. The second 90 speaks to the percent of people who know their status that are in treatment, and the very last 90% speaks of the percentage of people who are in treatment and their viral load is suppressed, and so they cannot really transmit HIV.
Right. So when COVID arrived a year ago, or just over a year ago now, in Cambodia, what were the fears? Were there concerns that there wouldn't be, with all the transport restrictions, that there wouldn't be a transfer of HIV medicines to the country?
You know, I think people living with HIV in Cambodia, as well, you know, as the rest of the Cambodians, were really under a huge stress, not only a health stress, but also a lot of stress was put on the economy of the country. And I think in particular for people living with HIV, one of the fears was, would they have continued access to both prevention and treatment services? So, you know, early in the pandemic last year, what UNAIDS has done together with the National AIDS Program, with the communities and different local organizations, we did a survey. We went and we asked people living with HIV and so-called key population, men who have sex with men, people who use drugs, transgender people, sex workers, what are their fears? How can we help them? What's the access to prevention and treatment services for them like since the COVID-19 pandemic started? And based on those answers, we decided to introduce early monitoring, and we're really looking at early indication of disruption of services. Second, we try to be a bit more innovative in the way we are offering services. You know, usually, in particular, the prevention services are offered in outreach work, which means people are going outside when we know where key populations are and offering prevention services, education, access to HIV testing to them outside. However, now we have moved most of the offer for HIV prevention services in the virtual world. We're using different social media platforms to reach out to them, and we have introduced HIV self-testing as yet another option.
So you feared the worst when the COVID-19 pandemic really shut down the country, and that included the closure of the biggest and oldest HIV treatment site in the capital, Phnom Penh. That was repurposed, wasn't it, to help COVID-19 patients?
True. One of the first efforts that Ministry of Health has done since the onset of the pandemic is really to have a central COVID-19 center. Unfortunately, the chosen selection was the oldest HIV treatment site in the capital. So what we have done, again, collectively with Ministry of Health and the National AIDS Program, we have ensured smooth transition of all patients, and that was the largest cohort of patients in Phnom Penh, into a new treatment site. We have provided, in addition to the services that have been offered, plus additional counselors, just to make sure that people knew where to go next and how to take up their medicines. And we have also provided face masks and sanitizers. The second effort that we have made is really we have used COVID-19 as an accelerator for promotion of multi-month dispensing of treatment. What does that mean? Instead of going every month to pick up your antiretroviral treatment, now people can go and pick up their treatment every 3 months, and some of them even on 6 month basis. That means that they go less frequently to the treatment site, which limits their exposure to COVID-19, but also saves them money that they would spend normally on transport.
So there's been no problem getting hold of HIV medicines during the pandemic and during the import-export restrictions that we've seen?
One of the biggest fears, obviously, was the potential indirect impact of COVID-19 on the supply chain. We were lucky enough that we have not recorded any shortages of medicine in Cambodia. We have started this multi-month dispensing before the onset of the pandemic. But, you know, 1 year ago, we had only 34% of people who are on treatment having access to multi-month dispensing. Today, we have more than 54% of people on treatment that have 3 or 6 months supply of their medicines.
And is there any stigma associated with HIV still in Cambodia, as there might be with COVID-19, or at least in the beginning?
Oh, we are still not immune to stigma and discrimination. And, you know, and this is sometimes coupled with a reluctance to disclose one HIV status, because the key population that I have referred to earlier on, men who have sex with men, people who use drugs, entertainment workers, transgender women, sometimes they buy or sell sex. And these people are really hard to reach with HIV intervention. And I think, again, this whole innovation of moving some of the services into the virtual space has opened a door to reach some of these unreached population and offer services to them, but also making sure that the uptake, particularly of HIV testing, as knowing your HIV status is very important, then you can know if and what prevention measures you should uptake, or if your HIV status is positive, how to get on treatment is very, very important.
UNAIDS is advocating that all countries, ministries of health and national AIDS programs grant access to 3 months or more of antiretroviral therapy for all people with HIV, including refugees and migrants. So how many countries currently support this three-month, this multi-month dispensary of HIV drugs?
In this region, Asia and the Pacific, most of the countries have already adopted that into their national programs. And I think, you know, Cambodia is not unique by using COVID-19 as an opportunity, really, to scale up these initiatives.